Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Well, welcome, welcome, welcome to a new episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Jake Porter, and I am so glad you have joined us here for another episode of the official podcast of APSATS. Hey, we know that when you are walking through this process of journey and recovery from betrayal trauma and sexual addiction, there are lots of questions that come up. Questions about where do we start? How do we find help? What's a good disclosure? What do I do if I want to give my wife a disclosure, but she doesn't want to hear it? Or the other way around, what do I do if I need a disclosure and my partner doesn't want to give it? Or my addicted partner's not willing to participate in this process of recovery? Lots of questions about boundaries. What are they? How do you set them? Today, what we're going to do in this episode is I'm going to pull a conversation that I had with a wonderful friend of mine and another member of the APSATS community, Andrea Rogers. Andrea Rogers is a board-certified coach. She's passionate about helping people heal from the pain of betrayal. She has over 20 years of experience helping others find passion and purpose in their lives. She is an APSATS-certified partner coach, and she believes that we can go from hurt to healed and ultimately find freedom on our journeys toward wholeness. Andrea recently joined me for a live Q&A session with part of the online summit that I just wrapped up doing, the Choose Connection Summit. Many of you who are listeners to this podcast have written and said that you heard about that summit from this podcast. You signed up, you claimed that free pass and got a lot out of it this past weekend, those 3 days. Well, this live Q&A was a part of it for those who supported the summit by buying a VIP pass, which actually helps us put it together and offer it for free to everyone else. So I'm going to make this available to all of you now because I think there's so much good, valuable information that come directly from questions from couples, men and women, both addicted partners and betrayed partners who are just trying to find their way through this process of recovery and healing. So I hope you'll enjoy that conversation. I also just want to mention that even right now, as this podcast episode is being released, I have the privilege of teaching the IRCM training with Carol the Coach, which is sponsored by APSATS. IRCM stands for Early Recovery Couples Empathy Model. We've got about 35 individuals there taking that training. It's a great training. Be looking at the APSATS website for other trainings that you might want to be a part of. Religious leader training coming up, the multidimensional partner trauma model training coming up. Those will both be offered this summer. And so if you've never done a training with APSATS and you work with those who are affected by betrayal trauma, I would really encourage you to take a look at that and make that investment in those resources. If you like this conversation with Coach Andrea and me, I hope that you'll maybe consider finding out more about that whole summit. You can do so by going to chooseconnectionsummit.com and you can learn more about how you could get access to the whole thing. All right. I hope that you are really encouraged and helped and informed by this Q&A session with Andrea Rogers.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hi. Hello, everybody. Let's see who all we've got. We've got 228 folks who have registered and will hopefully be in on this. at one point or another. Yeah, how about that? How about that? And welcome, everybody. Listen, I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and I'm joined by, oh, where'd she go? Where's Andrea Rogers?
I'm here.
Okay, we lost your video.
I'm here.
There you are.
Can
there you
see
are.
Me?
She's in her car right now driving at 80 miles an hour while answering questions. That is how talented
I'm that committed.
This woman is. Hey, my friend, thank you for being here. Why don't you take a few minutes before we jump into these questions and introduce yourself? Let people know who you are.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me today. My name is Andrea Rogers. I'm a board certified life coach. I'm also a certified partner coach with APSETS. I'm also a board member with APSETS. And I have been in this recovery space for about 8 years. As a result of my own recovery journey, I work with partners who are experiencing betrayal. I work with people who are engaging in problematic sexual behavior, and I also work with couples.
There you go. And she's just a fine human being as
well.
Well,
thank you. Thank you.
Yes. All right. You ready, Andrea? We're going to do this?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Okay. So I'm going to turn to the first question I got yesterday, which is this. How can I share full disclosure with my wife when she has not been willing to talk with anyone and has no support of any kind? Andrea, I'm going to let you start with that.
Wow. That's a big one.
Yeah.
So I appreciate whoever asked that question, because it shows thought and care for their spouse,
absolutely,
which is really important when you're doing a disclosure. So I would say, I'm not sure what resources you have on disclosure. If you follow Jake's YouTube page, he has tons of short little snippets about recovery, disclosure, partner's brain, that type of thing. Maybe your spouse would be open to just watching some short resources to understand why disclosure is important. Also, many partners have experienced what we call dribble disclosures, where they get a little bit here and a little bit there, and they don't want to sit through that type of experience anymore. But if they know that this is a therapeutic process where they're going to be supported, where for the first time they're going to get to know the full truth, that this can be a huge part of the healing, and that they can for the first time make fully informed consent about how they want to move forward in the relationship, that can be very encouraging for them to engage in the process. So if your voice is not being heard, I would say find the voice of a trusted professional like a Jake Porter or any other resources that you can find online that talk about what a full therapeutic disclosure is, how it can be helpful for the healing process, and that may encourage your spouse to get the help and support that they need.
Yeah. I'm going to ditto every single bit of that. My YouTube channel, I threw the link to it in the chat in case anyone wants that. Another really great resource for disclosure is a set of workbooks by, Janice Caudle and Dan Drake.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So you can get those on Amazon, I think. Janice Caudle, Dan Drake, their disclosure workbooks. They've got one for addicts and one for partners. Now, listen, I strongly, strongly, strongly suggest, just like you already heard, that you want to have support from a trained professional, a coach, a therapist. If the next best thing to you each having that support person would be to at least you – who asked this question wanting to give the disclosure, you work with someone on preparing it and see if she's at least willing to join with your professional support person in that process of actually receiving it. That would be, I think, the very next best thing. And maybe she'd be willing to do some of that preparation work from that workbook ahead of time, maybe. But I appreciate your heart, kind of like Andrea said when she kicked off the answer there, your heart to want to do this for your partner and want to do it the right way so it doesn't cause more damage. Okay.
Absolutely.
There is another question here. It says, I know my husband was unfaithful, but he denies it to this day. I asked him one final time and said, I just need to know the truth so we can move forward. I will not ask again. I'm not going anywhere. He said, no, we're just friends. 22 years of trying to be a quiet witness. I've suffered and have almost no self-respect. How can I get past this? You want to take that first?
Didn't I just hit you?
First? It's horrible.
You go first. Yeah, it's horrible. Just hit me in the heart. So you okay. go first, and I'll chime in.
I sure will. So, you know, the first thing I want to say, I'm going to get a little bit emotional. I want to say that I'm really sorry. I'm making up based on some of the phrases you used in your question that people have used scripture against you and have convinced you to stay in what could very well be an abusive situation and use the Bible to back that up. That quiet witness piece, thinking about the passage from 1 Peter. And I'm really sorry that that might be part of your story. And as a former pastor of a American conservative evangelical church, I am sorry for that, for you and any other who are listening who've been in that place. I think that 1 Corinthians 7 makes it pretty clear that if your spouse is deserting you, then you're free to go. And deserting you doesn't mean only leaving the house. There are lots of ways that people are deserted. Now, listen, I'm not pro-divorce. I'm not telling you to get a divorce. I think anybody who knows me and knows my work knows I'm all in it to save relationships, and I believe in that. But it takes two. And what I hear is this guy's not willing to do even some very basic level matters of integrity and trustworthiness. And I believe that gives you on that. Now the ball's back in your court, terrible as that is. But now you get to make a choice based on that. I'm going to stop there. Andrea, pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, this is a story that I hear so many times for partners. I know something in my gut, right? I ask him, he won't admit to it. And it hurt my heart to hear 22 years of this person suffering silently. So my first thing is to just say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you're with someone who's not willing to be honest, who's not willing to honor you and your vows in a way that they deserve to be honored. But the second thing I would say is trust your gut. If you are suspecting that something is off, you're probably right. You may not know all the details, but if you feel unsafe, let's say that even this person is just a friend. But you're saying to your partner, I feel unsafe around this person, and they are choosing to ignore that. What is that telling you? Part of, you know, Jake talks about this a lot, relational safety, those ABCs, right? I have to know I'm accepted, I belong, you're committed, you're going to choose me. And it sounds like you're not feeling chosen. And in not being chosen, there's a neglect of your emotional needs. There's a lack of relational safety. And a marriage, a relationship cannot thrive in that type of environment. So for you, I would say get support for you. Get a coach, get a counselor, someone who can come alongside you, walk you through setting good boundaries, bring you back to your core values, and help you make some decisions that are going to be good for you and for your future. I know for me, in my relationship, it was the same thing. There was this long kind of nagging question. And one of the things that I wish I had done sooner was trusted my voice. So that's always my encouragement to partners. Wisdom is your gift. God has given you that. Use it, tap into it. Your life is valuable. Your relationship is such a huge part of your life. And if you feel unsafe in that, that impacts every other area of your life. And so establish that safety within yourself. Find a coach or counselor to come alongside you and support you. Identify your values, set some boundaries, and then make some decisions based on all of those pieces of information.
Well said. That's well said. Okay, I want to get in as many of these as we can. This is a fun one. I'm actually really curious to hear your answer on this one, Andrea. So, it says, how does recovery look different for couples that aren't married? Are there important specific differences that should be taken into account in order to respect pre-marriage boundaries? For example, talking about sexual things or differences in the disclosure process. Thoughts on that?
It's an interesting question. I would be wondering, are they planning on getting married?
That would be my first question as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you're planning on getting married, I would say no. Your premarital relationship is setting the foundation for your marital relationship. And so if you're doing this disclosure, you're going through recovery in hopes and engaging in a longer term relationship, then you want to lay a good foundation now, right?
Yes, that's right. I agree with that. That was my first thought as well, is, you know, like, okay, so how advanced is this relationship? And what I would go back to is the way I define intimacy is that intimacy is knowing and being known at deeper and deeper levels over time to whatever extent is appropriate to that relationship, right? Mm-hmm. So if I've been dating someone a month, I don't need to give them a full disclosure. If I've been dating someone 3 months, I probably don't need to give them full disclosure. But if it's starting to get serious, I might let a little bit out. I might say, hey, I want you to know that a part of my story involves addiction and recovery. And I want you to know that up front. I'm not at a place yet where I want to share all of those details with you, but I want to be honest with you. Do you have questions about that? Because I do want to answer what I'm comfortable answering at this point. I promise you, I'll tell you more if we continue to move forward in this relationship. And so knowing and being known at deeper and deeper levels over time, certainly by the point you get engaged. Okay. If someone's committing to marrying you, then they have a right, I think, to know the whole story. That would be my thought on that. So.
Yeah, you made me think about that Brene Brown, where she says that people have to earn the right to hear our story.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, in the beginning, especially if you're just dating, some of those questions around pornography may come up. If you know you're struggling with it and ask, I think being honest and giving those answers. But like you said, a full disclosure, it's like you want to give that to someone that's earned the right, that you know you're committed to, that you're planning a future for. But that's not something you're going to bring on a first date. Like, here's my disclosure.
Yeah. My former therapist used to call that vomiting your garlic milkshake all over someone. Like, you get their first date, you just tell them all of this stuff. Not a good thing to do. Not a good start.
Would not recommend.
No, exactly. Okay, so I'm going to bounce from the emails to what was sent in here. It says, it says right here, I believe my husband's affair is a result of unresolved deep emotions he never got to the bottom of, and has an addictive personality and doesn't realize he's chasing an addiction of the feeling in love and not the reality. What's your advice on trying to get him to work on his deep issues and end the affair? You want me to take this one first?
You go. Yeah. And then okay. I'll chime in.
So I'm going to say, I'm curious how what you'll think about this, Andrea. So I'm going to say to you, person who asked this question, there's no one in the world with more power in this relationship with your husband than you. And if he is continuing actively in an affair, I'm not saying go file for divorce tomorrow. I'm not saying that at all. But begin with what are you doing? What boundaries are you setting for what you're okay with and what you're not okay with? What are you doing to protect yourself, to stay in integrity with your own values, while he is continuing to make those choices? Right? What choices are you making so that you are not in a relationship that is harmful to you and contrary to your own values? I would start there. To take that one step further, that's what you can do. What you can't do is make him deal with his emotions or make him deal with his past. But what you can do, I think, is you can say something like, if you want to stay in this relationship with me, I need you to be seeing a qualified therapist who specializes in this area, and I need you to follow all of that professional's treatment recommendations. And if you don't, then I will remove myself from this relationship. That, to me, that's your best bet. I would not be machine gun shooting at him links to blogs and podcasts, and I would not be calling therapists seeing if they have availability on his behalf. I would not be registering him for any webinars. I would say to him, this is what I need you to do, and if you don't do this, I'm going to need to remove myself from the relationship. Andrea, what are your thoughts? Yeah.
I'm feeling like a bobblehead a little bit over here because I'm just like, I'm just nodding. Yes, yes, and yes. And that term in there, how can I get him to? There's a quote that says, a person convinced against his will is of the same opinion still.
Ooh, that's good.
Partners want so much to convince, to get this person to see. That person has to make the choice to see. I'm preparing a talk on boundaries, and one of the things that I bring up is this idea of the Garden of Eden. God says, here's what's required in order for this to be an ideal environment, right? You can do this, you can do this, and you can do this. What you cannot do is this, because then it will cause this environment not to be ideal anymore. And when a partner is learning to set boundaries, like you described, and I think this would be essential in this case, it would be, here's what it looks like for us to have a happy, healthy marriage. These things exist. Right now, I'm feeling like these things don't exist. So then what happens when it's a less than ideal environment? What boundaries do you need to put in place that make your spouse, well, let me rephrase that, not make your spouse, but help your spouse to see what needs to be done, what you need in order to feel safe, and how they can contribute to creating a healthy relationship. They get a choice, right? Like God gave Adam and Eve a choice. He didn't put barriers up around the tree, say you can't get to it. He left it fully accessible, but he said, if you do this, then here's going to be my choice. And like you said, if you say to your spouse, hey, I'm feeling really unsafe. It feels like there are some dynamics that are existing in our relationship that are unhealthy. And what I need is this, right? And then if they don't do that, well, my choice will be to do this. So if your spouse refuses to get help, if they have unhealthy communication patterns, what can you do? You can choose not to engage in dialogue with them around highly emotional topics. You can choose to practice healthy detachment. You may pull back a little bit in terms of the relational intimacy, right? You may say, I just don't feel safe going there. But what you cannot do is convince or get someone to do something until they are convinced that they need to do it. And so sometimes that convincing comes through boundaries and some of the consequences that come with those boundaries.
All right. So I'm going to go on to the next question here. This says, I'm in an uncommon situation where I am a betrayed male partner and my fiance is a woman recovering from pornography addiction. Most betrayal trauma recovery resources are geared towards or exclusively designed for women. This makes it very difficult to heal and move forward. And I'm at a point where I feel like I'm lagging behind my fiance's growth because of it. Is there any advice you can give me for how to keep moving forward and build a support system when gender plays such an issue for accessibility? So absolutely, you are so right. First of all, there aren't that many resources for betrayed partners to begin with, and there are way fewer even resources for male betrayed partners. A couple of things, though. There is a trauma-based 12-step group called Infidelity Survivors Anonymous. Infidelity Survivors Anonymous. I am looking up the website right now. I think it's isurvivors.com. Let me see. Infidelity Survivors Anonymous. Infidelity Survivors Anonymous. The website is, isurvivors.org. And I am pretty sure that they have some meetings that are for male partners. So that's one potential. In fact, they do. I just looked it up for you. There's a Thursday male partner meeting, and then they've got some co-ed meetings as well because there are so few resources. And then I'm looking at one more. There's another website. Yep, I'm going to put the link to this one in the chat box. MalePartnersOfFemaleSexAddicts.com. Stacy Sprout, who is a CSAT up in the, I think she's in the Seattle area. She's in the Pacific Northwest somewhere. Putting this website together, and it's got a lot of resources for male partners. So I would say go to those two places. One other one that I would look at is Rob Weiss's free online community. I think it's sex and relationshiphealing.com. Just Google Rob Weiss. I think it's sex and relationshiphealing.com. He's got lots of free resources, including a lot of groups. And I believe he's got a group for male partners as well. She's back.
I'm so sorry. It just kicked me out.
It's all right. Glad you're back. Glad you're back. I just addressed a question asking about resources for male betrayed partners. I pointed to some ISA groups that are for males, Stacy Sprout's website, Male Partners of Female Sex Addicts. And I think Rob Weiss's free online recovery community has some stuff. Do you know of anything else for male partners, Andrea?
Yes. I think, I hope I'm not misquoting, but I think Michelle Mays has a few things for male partners. Sybil, I can't say her last name. She actually just wrote a book. And she's an ABSATS therapist. She wrote a book and she has a group for that. I will find the name of that here while we're talking and okay. Put it in the chat.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. Let me go back over here. See what the next question I have is. Okay. It says, how can the partner know or figure out for oneself What disclosure questions a betrayed partner should ask? How do they figure out for themselves what they actually want to know and don't know? Oh,
that's a juicy one.
That's a good one. That's a really good one. And are you still searching for that? Because I'll start if you are.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'll start this one. So I would say, first of all, if you are able, if you've got the resources to work with someone like Andrea, work with a trained coach or APSAT's trained therapist, I would start there, because they've got not just the training, but the experience of having gone through this process with people many times. There's a lot that we learn by doing, right? And learning, oh, this is a good question, that's a good question. So if you can get support in that way, do it. The next best thing would be something like Janice Caudle and Dan Drake's Disclosure Prep Workbook for Partners. They're going to have resources inside that workbook about questions. But here's what it comes down to for me. It is, you want to ask questions that are going to lead you to a place of rebuilding confidence in your own intuition. I want you to think about, that night he said, oh my goodness, that meeting went late, and it just felt different to you than all the other times he had said that. There was just something in your gut that said that was off. Or that vacation, you went out and you said you were just going to go for a walk and drive around town for a little bit that afternoon, and you came back and I just felt like something was off. Did you act out during those questions where your mind remembers that your gut was saying, those are the times to ask about. Because to me, one of the healing functions of a good disclosure process is you reestablishing trust in your own intuition. After being gaslit, after having your reality warped and bended all around you, you deserve to have that experience of going, oh, I was right. Oh, I knew it. So there's some of my input. Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Having a guide, a disclosure guide, is so helpful in this case, because that person can help you think through questions that may not even come to your mind. Sometimes when I talk to partners, I say, have you ever questioned this? Have you ever thought about this? And they're like, yeah, but you've gotten so used to dismissing your own voice, like you said, Jake, that you don't even think to include those kinds of questions. So what do you want to know? First, things that have been nagging at you. Every partner has a list of questions that, like, I thought that, but he said this, that sounded strange. And coming back to those questions first. And then some of the other ones that you may not be able to think of, your disclosure guide, the person that you're working with, can help you come up with those. Dan and Janice's book can help you come up with those. And then in terms of what not to ask. So Dr. Sherry Keffer, who's one of the speakers here this weekend, always says there's no bleach for the brain.
So that's so good.
It is good, because as you get into every detail that you learn, you will have to process and work through. So ask yourself, am I wanting to know, is this going to help me heal in some way? Is this going to fill in a gap? Like I describe disclosure as putting together a puzzle, right? Is this going to fit nicely into this puzzle? Or is this going to be a detail that doesn't really help me get a better picture, but just drills down into all the thousands of questions that my mind had? So being wise with your questions, feeling safe to ask the right questions, but also using wisdom not to ask too many questions that give you too much detail that you will not be able to forget.
Yeah. Good. Well said. Well said. Okay. Here's another question that was emailed in. It's a little longer, but I'm going to read it because I think it's important. This is a great question. My husband and I enjoyed the talk with Wendell yesterday. We are definitely in that roller coaster of early recovery connection. My husband has tried to be vulnerable with me about things from his childhood that were traumatic and led to his addiction. While I want to be compassionate and loving to build trust, I find that I end up getting triggered myself about my own childhood trauma and resentful to him because in some ways his childhood was so much better and more stable than mine as I currently understand it. How can I balance this and learn to be compassionate to him and remind myself that someone suffering with a broken toe is still suffering even when you have a broken leg? This seems to be a continued challenge for me in many ways of comparing my trauma with others' trauma. I struggle to connect with betrayed spouses and groups well because their experiences are usually worse than mine. So I feel like I don't deserve to be upset when listening to them. I don't know why my mind works this way, but it is a double-edged sword for me. You want to take that one first, Andrea?
Yeah, I just have so much compassion for this partner because it sounds like part of your childhood trauma may be that you weren't allowed to process your grief or your pain, right? Sounds like it may have been minimized or even dismissed. And that's something we learn how to do when people around us don't validate us, when they don't attune to our pain and our grief, or even if they're not available, right? Like, let's say you have a single mom who's just at work all the time and can't be there. And so you learn these patterns of behavior that don't allow for self-compassion, which is where you give yourself permission to feel your grief and your pain and understanding that there's no comparison in suffering. And so I don't know if this person has a coach or a therapist, but that would be where I would start, is being able to have compassion for yourself first. It's hard to do that for someone else if you can't do that for yourself. So if you're constantly minimizing your own experience, well, mine isn't as important as theirs, then of course it's going to be difficult for you to hold space for someone else. And in that early couple stage, you know, that is so common. You want so bad to come together and be connected. But understanding you have to learn those skills. You have to learn how to listen well to each other, to practice empathy, to validate each other. And that's something that takes time. So in early couples work, that's not something that people do automatically. It's a process to get there.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, as Andrea was mentioning self-compassion, I was putting in the chat box a link to self-compassion.org. That's the website for Kristen Neff. She is a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin and researches self-compassion. And there are lots of free resources about self-compassion at that website. And it is absolutely true. The research has shown if you don't start with compassion toward yourself, you will quickly run out of compassion for others. And self-compassion is not selfish. It is necessary. Hey, we're to love your neighbor. How? As yourself.
Yourself.
So this is a super important thing. I also want to say, sounds like you and your husband are both really trying it, right? Like, you recognize that he's trying to share this with me. I'm trying to be compassionate to him. He's trying to open up to me. And right. I mean, it sounds like you are trying to do this connection thing. Keep coming back to that. Look, you're going to fumble the ball. You're going to trip and fall. You're going to mess this thing up. He is too. As soon as it's all messed up, take a deep breath, look at each other and say, but we're both trying, right? Yeah, we are. We're both trying. And come back to that. Come back to what you know, you both know to be true. Come back to that. Reset. Try a do-over the next day, you know? But keep at it, because it's going to be worth it for you, for him, and for your marriage. Thank you for sending that question. And that was a really good one. Okay. Here's another one over here. Let's see. Where was that one that I saw? Okay. My husband is in from the oil field and works out of town for 2 weeks plus at a time. When we had the dribble disclosures, I have always been told that they were just websites. He has consistently said that in our situation, there has only been things that he has said, but never engaged with another woman physically or met another woman. What do I do if I don't believe him? It feels like I will never feel any different. You want to take it, Andrea?
Yeah. What do you do if you don't believe him? Don't believe him. and I'm not saying that to be mocking or make light of it, but if you don't believe it, that's something in you saying something is off. I encourage you to trust that. Dribble disclosures are so painful because it's like death by a thousand cuts, right? You hear a little, you want to believe it, you get your hopes up, and then next time you hear a little bit more and a little bit more. And it is just so painful to go through that process. So I would encourage your spouse to say, hey, I want a full therapeutic disclosure. Use your voice and ask for what you need. It's important for me to have the truth. It's hard for me to trust you when you do this and then say this, right? So the words and the actions don't match. And when you're in that situation, it can be crazy making. And you can start to doubt yourself. So a full therapeutic disclosure will get you the full truth all at the same time in a safe therapeutic environment where you and your partner can both start to work on healing from a place of truth.
Absolutely. I'm just going to ditto that, and I'm putting into the chat box a YouTube of an AppSats podcast episode that I just did with Stephen Kabler, who is a polygraph examiner who does polygraphs with in the disclosure process. And you can learn a lot about that process and how to get the truth verified and why it's not a sham and all of that in that episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, the podcast of AppSats. So you'll find that link right there. Okay, another question that I just saw. It says, as a husband who has done the betraying, my wife and I have completed disclosure and have experienced therapy with me. After about a year, we still live apart. I am concerned about healing separately and what the risks of that are. Can you talk about the risks of that? How can I help to decrease that fear of reuniting? So I'll start with this one because I've been putting you on the spot, leading the way in a lot of these. I'll take this one first. So, you know, the first thing that comes up for me thinking about that is you gotta identify where is there still a lack of safety and stabilization. So people are naturally oriented to move toward healing. If that is not happening, something is in the way. Now, I want to say to this husband, that doesn't mean it's your fault. It might be. Okay. It could be something. It could be something you're doing, but it might not be also. Either way, the best thing you can do is approach it from a place of compassion and understanding if we're not moving forward toward that post-traumatic growth and revisioning the relationship, there's still a lack of safety and stabilization somewhere. What is it? And how can that be shored up? You know? So again, it could be something you're doing or not doing. It may not. It could be that your partner needs some additional trauma work. It could be that your partner needs some more information. You know, sometimes information is really helpful. Was there something from the disclosure that kind of got stuck in there and is still very raw? So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is this. I try to tell couples, don't look at reuniting after a separation as an off-on switch. Like it's an all nothing, zero or one, you know, we're together or we're apart. You can titrate this thing. So titration is like working your way into it. And validate this is scary for her. But rather than moving all your stuff in right away, can you start with weekends, or maybe even one weekend a month, or shoot, maybe it's one night a month. I don't know. Maybe it's one night a month. You're in the same house, but still in a different room. But can you slice it thinner? Okay. But that way you're at least moving in the direction that you both want to go. Right. So that it's not like I have to be completely ready for him to move back in and back in the bedroom and sharing a bed again before we do anything. Any other thoughts there, Andrea?
Yeah, I was going to say ask your spouse, what do they think would need to happen in order for you guys to start moving towards reconciliation? This person mentioned disclosure and counseling. Are they in couples counseling? That would be another thing that I would say, and start working on dating. How do you do small dates? Re-engage with each other, relearn each other. But one of the things I see a lot, excuse me, with guys in recovery is they have a lot of conversations in their head that don't make it out of their head through their mouth. So they're making up stories of, well, we're not together because of this, or this, or this, or this, rather than asking. And the more you can ask over assuming, the more you learn how to engage with your partner and not make up those stories in your head. So I would say to this person, start a conversation with your spouse. Ask them what they would need in order to feel safe. But I agree with you, Jake. If they're not moving together, that tells me that there's something there that's preventing that relational safety to be present. And you know, when we look at that intimacy pyramid, if trust and safety, that foundation isn't there, it's hard to build any of those other blocks.
That's right. That's right. Thank you. Okay, let's flip back over to the inbox here. It says, my husband has been a sex addict for over 40 years. We've been married for 25. We just had formal therapeutic disclosure followed by polygraph in November, which was devastating, but also so important in finding out the full scope of his addiction. Subsequent to that, I had a million questions, and although he answered all of them, he was withholding some information around an affair, and it took almost 2 months to get the full truth. He appears to be really committed to his recovery with 12-step meetings every day. That's impressive. A CSAT and a men's group, in addition to our couple CSAT, and I also have my own. He is currently living outside our home for a therapeutic separation at my request. It started as a 3-month separation, but I've since extended it. The challenge is still accountability. We have agreements in place, and he has broken 3 of them in the last 2 weeks. I feel like he is doing it out of a defiant stance. He is trying hard, but I feel like he is pushing back on anything that looks like someone telling him what to do. Is this normal? And besides me holding tight to my boundaries, is there something else I can be doing for me to ride this out? I'm going to take that one first, Andrea.
Well, instantly, I thought about your teaching on that. What is it? Capacity versus ability.
Capacity versus skill. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first thing that came to my mind. The second thing was, I heard you say he's doing a lot of recovery work. I'm wondering what changes you're seeing as a result of that work, because I feel like recovery can become its own addiction, right? I'm in all my meetings. I'm going to all my sessions, I'm doing all of this, but I'm checking boxes, but there's no fruit from this work. So I'm curious if this partner is seeing actual fruit and this is the only thing that's nagging, or is there a lot of work being done, but maybe not a lot of fruit being produced from that work? This person may be a performer and, you know, can check those boxes, but I would have some more questions about that. But your teaching about, do they have the capacity, right? Is there a childhood trauma there tied to, maybe they had a very aggressive parent who was right, very authoritative and did not give them a lot of freedom or choice. because that could be playing into it as well. But I would think that getting a little bit more curious, maybe exploring this in some couple sessions would be helpful, and digging a little deeper with a professional who can help get to the root about what's going on here for this spouse.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. That's well said. And I'll add to that, listen, I am not anti 12 step. I'm in recovery. I'm a grateful 12 stepper myself. I identify as a 12 stepper. And the 12 steps can sometimes be implemented in a way, some of those traditional recovery models that are 12 step focused can be implemented in such a way that it doesn't really help the relationship and can actually come between the relationship. And here's how I explain this. So a little mini teaching here. So imagine that there are three levels of relational health. Okay. Level one is really unhealth. It's I exist to take care of you, or you exist to take care of me. And maybe we swap out on that, but it's never truly mutual, right? It's what in the old days people would have called codependence. And I want to stay away from that word, but it's very much about, like, you know, one person is just almost an extension of the other, if that makes sense. Well, that's not good. That's not healthy. And a lot of addicts, even if they're partners, and this is why I don't want to call it codependence, because their partners may not be in that mindset or realize that's what's going on. They think they're just being good, loving partners. But the addict's view, non-consciously, is, well, that person exists to take care of me because I'm the center of the world, right? Or it really can be the other way around. My only value is in being there for other people and performing for other people. Regardless, that's really unhealthy. The level two relationships say, hey, I'm responsible for me and you're responsible for you. And that is true, number one. And getting to level two, if you've lived in level one, it feels a whole lot better than level one. And you can make it sound really nice and like a Hallmark card, right? Like, I take care of me for you, you take care of you for me. And that's great. And 12 step is good at getting people there. But there's another level. Level three is I can take care of myself and my partner at the same time. I can look for solutions that are win-win-wins. Win for me, win for my partner, win for the marriage, win for the relationship. It sounds like he might be doing a whole bunch of recovery work that's leaving him in level two, okay? Where he's not learning how to get beyond being responsible for himself to also taking ownership of the care of the relationship. So I would say, and I don't know who your couple CSAT is, and maybe they're doing great work, and don't even tell me, I don't want to know. But I would say if they don't understand, if your couple's therapist doesn't understand this more couple-centered approach, if they're trying to fit your relationship into a level two relationship, okay, and that's not what you want for your relationship, find a different therapist or coach who's going to help y'all get to level three. Andrea does that. She works with couples. She's done some couples training with me on working with couples. There's also ERCEM, ERCEM, which is Carol, the coach, and I help teach it with her training on working with couples in recovery. Find support that shares the vision you have for your relationship. So that was a lot. Play it back in the webinar so you can really get that. And maybe you need to re-interview your couple's support person to see if they're helping you get where you want to go. All right. There's a note that just got put. I would recommend James and Sharon from day one for this couple to listen to together. I'm 5 years sober and see many areas they talked about that could help this guy. So there's a good good promo for our friends James and Sharon. They are on day one that you still have access to. Well, you guys will have access to that forever. Okay, here's one that just came in. Might be our last one here. It says, I can relate to the last question. I am the addict currently in therapeutic separation, and the struggle for me is I feel I am being accountable, but it has been 2.5 years since discovery. There is a lot of areas of accountability, and I, during this separation, have violated a couple of things, and that becomes the focus. And my feeling is she wants perfection. Any feedback would be appreciated. Take it away, Andrea.
Oh, boy. I literally just had this conversation yesterday. I think so many guys feel this in recovery. And partners can be hypervigilant, right? They've been gaslit. They've been manipulated. They've been deceived. And so it's like, no, I don't trust that. This violated a couple of things. I'm curious what those couple of things would be. Number one, because it's the little things that make a big difference. When you can keep your word in the little things with your partner, it helps you to build trust in the big things. So in violating those things, have you taken responsibility for them, or have you been defensive? Have you been able to have empathy for your partner if this triggered her during the separation? Have you made a concerted effort to not do that again? So I would say that, number one, check in with your partner. These things that you're violating, are they creating that sense of not being safe for her? That's what it sounds like. And then number two, let's say this is right. Let's say she is wanting perfection. What happens? Partners are like, nope, I settled for this, that, and the other. I'm not doing it again. He has to get it all right. This is where couples counseling or coaching can be very helpful to help point out this relationship dynamic between the two of you that may be going on.
Absolutely. Yep. I back that up. Ditto all that. Often it's less about the violation, the couple of violations, and more about what do you do when there is a violation? Are you handling it differently? When she comes and she blows up, what do you do then? Do you show up as the guy in recovery, the guy in integrity, or do you say, oh my gosh, I've done all of this stuff and I did, you know, I messed up here and now you're going to focus on it, because that's not going to get you what you want. So, and trying to understand that it can feel like a power differential, right? Where her expectations are so high and like she's just looking down on you down there and you've got to jump through all these hoops. It can feel that way. And I'm not saying no betrayed partner can ever go there. Someone could go there as a way of coping, and that's not helpful, and it's not right, and it's not going to ultimately get anybody what they want. But often it's not about jumping through hoops or perfection. It's about, will you demonstrate to me that I can trust making myself vulnerable with you again? And I put in the chat box there a link, okay? I put a link there. Called to a short video. It's like 5 minutes long, called Are You on the Coaster, that I created. And it's a helpful illustration to help the ones who did the betraying try to understand what their partners are looking for or not. Becky just said in the comments there, if they were able to get curious about the response or the action, that would help. Absolutely. Curiosity. You can never go wrong with being curious in a healthy, you know, whole brain way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Andrea, how can people get a hold of you if they want to work with you?
If they want to work with me, go to my website, fullyalivecoachingllc.com. Click the Get Started button and all the details are there.
There you go. You won't go wrong doing that, folks. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Andrea. Y'all enjoy the rest of the summit.
Absolutely. Take care. Thank you, Jake. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of AppSats. If you've received help or hope from this episode, I encourage you to share it with someone you know. If you've not yet done so, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening platform. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Jake Porter, and you can always email me directly at jake@appsats.org. I'd love to hear your ideas, questions, or comments about the show. Until next time, keep choosing to use your voice and live your values. It's good for you and for this world.